Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I'll be your host for the next hour. We have a lineup for you this morning which melds history, politics, and culture. We'll lead off with Laurie Messier and Miriam Pemberton on rethinking warfare economies. Then Bill Resnick speaks with Jeremy Brucker about prospects for a political uprising over the failure of leaders to adequately address the climate crisis. Closing our show today will be Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker with their discussion of the Black Lives Matter photo exhibit at the Portland Art Museum. For decades, Miriam Pemberton has studied the U.S. military economy and how to shrink it down to size. A fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, she headed up the team that produced three successive reports comparing budgets for military versus climate security. Here's Laurie Messier speaking with Miriam about her new book, Six Stops on the National Security Tour, Rethinking Warfare Economies.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Miriam Pemberton about her new book, Six Stops on the National Security Tour, Rethinking Warfare Economies. Miriam Pemberton has studied the U.S. military economy and the means of shrinking it down to size for decades. First as director of the National Commission for Economic Conversion and Disarmament, and then as a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. With William Hartung, she edited Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and headed up the team that produced three successive versions of Military versus Climate Security, The Budgets Compared. Welcome to KBOO, Miriam Pemberton.
Thanks so much.
Well, Congress recently passed close to a $1 trillion military budget, which is almost $40 billion more than what the Biden administration requested, already the largest military budget in U.S. history. To understand how this military budget grew to historic proportions, you write about how the warfare economy is woven into every fabric of American society and is designed to perpetuate itself. Can you describe how this integrated warfare economy of military bases, nuclear weapons labs, missile silos, and military and high-tech surveillance production sites extend far beyond the Washington, D.C. beltway into every state of the Union and in every congressional district as well?
So much of this military reach was established by World War II. So one chapter in the book, I go to Los Alamos, which is, you know, high up on a mesa in New Mexico and where the Manhattan Project started developing the first nuclear weapons and, of course, is now still up there. They had a moment after the Cold War ended when they were really seriously considering, do we really need these nuclear weapons labs now that the Soviet Union has collapsed? But, you know, those thoughts went away, and so they're still very much in the business. After World War II, there was a period when some of the military contractors who had supplied the weapons for World War II went back to what they'd originally been working on. For example, GM, you know, turned from cars to tanks and then back to cars again. Then we had, you know, the Cold War, and a lot of the companies supplying the Cold War were companies who had never done anything else besides military production. There, with the Cold War, began the new idea that we needed a permanent war economy, not just a war economy for the wars we were fighting, but, you know, this permanent ability to project our power through military force. Then at the end of the Cold War, this whole enormous infrastructure of military production and bases and the rest were kind of felt endangered. You know, do we really need all this stuff? And so they developed or they strengthened this a strategy of instead of, you know, placing military facilities and production facilities where they needed to be, they instead began spreading military contracts in as many congressional districts as they could. So the largest weapons system in the world, this is this F-35 fighter jet, the company Lockheed Martin advertises on its website that it is built in 45 states. And, you know, they brag about it. And so, you know, this is obviously not a recipe for industrial efficiency, but it is a recipe for political protection. So the more places that feel that they must have high military spending so that they can protect the jobs in their districts, the more this sort of circle is completed. And, you know, there's this, you know, very potent way of keeping military budgets high, not higher than any time in our history, because that was World War II, but any time since then.
And it seems like this Lockheed Martin example you gave really illustrates how these companies or contractors keep the funds rolling in. The F-35 fighter jet you mentioned, I bet they don't brag on their website how they keep going back to the drawing board and they've been working on this fighter jet for over 30 years.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think there are two responses that are in the book to sort of come back on this political strategy. So one is a series of studies by economists who have shown if you plug a lot of military spending into, you know, all these congressional districts, you are going to create a lot of jobs. That's just inevitable. But these economic studies show that you're actually creating fewer jobs from military spending than you are if you put that money into, for example, education or healthcare or clean energy. And the other thing I discovered while I was doing the research was kept finding places I was going, such as Los Alamos, where the lab, the national lab, is, has one of the highest per capita incomes in the country. And then at the bottom of this mesa is where the adjacent county is, has one of the lowest per capita incomes. So I looked fairly systematically at the most defense-dependent counties and states and compared them to the national average poverty rate, and found that in more than half the cases, this place where concentrated military spending was, the poverty rate was higher than the national average. You know, there is this prosperity gospel of military spending. You need more military spending because it builds prosperity. And what I found was there are a lot of holes in that argument.
Yeah, that's one of the many myths that you explode in this book. And I want to get back to Los Alamos and the fact that you frame your study as a tour. And of course, this tour is different from any other guidebook in that it takes us to these six different sites that represent different dimensions of the Pentagon's reach. And you include places like Los Alamos in Southern California, which might be expected as sites of military dependence. But what about some of the other places you discuss, like Pine Bluff, Arkansas, or some of the other places that would be unfamiliar to most readers when they think about the military-industrial complex?
Yeah. So Pine Bluff, Arkansas is this kind of destitute place in the poorest quadrant of one of the poorest states in America, namely Arkansas. And it's where the U.S. created its chemical weapons stockpiles during World War II. And then they, you know, kept on making them until we had the Chemical Weapons Convention that banned chemical weapons around the world. And so suddenly this base was kind of out of business. And so then they had to figure out, you know, what else do we do? And the places I visited, in each case, they had something else going for them that they could use to create economic development. And in particular, I was looking for, you know, in my view, the most important national security challenge we have in front of us, and every other kind of challenge, is climate change. And so, you know, I looked at places where there were opportunities to transition, you know, the military production to something that will actually help us address the climate crisis. And in the case of Pine Bluff, this is out in the middle of nowhere, an enormous laboratory. It's the only Food and Drug Administration lab outside of D.C. It started out in the middle of nowhere next to this chemical weapons production facility to develop chemical weapons designs. And then in the 70s, actually it was Richard Nixon who decided, no, it's going to now convert itself and work on figuring out, you know, what chemicals in our environment are potentially hazardous to our health. And so there's a possibility of using that lab to develop technologies that could become, you know, economic development moneymakers for this very destitute community. It hasn't really happened yet, but it's a possibility.
And that seems to be an important way to convince people that by redeploying those resources that currently go into the military-industrial complex, that we could use those resources in ways to prevent catastrophic climate change and also make sure that these communities are repurposed to pursue climate and human needs. This is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm speaking with Miriam Pemberton about her book, Six Stops on the National Security Tour, Rethinking Warfare Economies. And Miriam, you, in addition to referring to how this national security apparatus, military spending, permeates almost every state and how contractors ingeniously or deviously created that kind of web, even though that's very inefficient, but just to make sure that they have the votes in Congress to keep the money flowing. But how is this language of national security manipulated to create this kind of web of military spending and political support?
The term national security didn't really exist until after World War II. I would say there's no more popular way to get support for national policy beyond calling it a national security necessity. So national security it's never really been defined. And if you can't define it, you know, how do you figure out how much to spend on it? As I said in the book, when you're talking about security, the argument for more money always starts out ahead because everyone wants security. But, you know, I make the argument that, you know, national security has become this kind of talismanic power that is being wielded to protect spending that really ought to be spent on other things.
Right, rather than 750 military bases around the world and larger military budget than the 12 following countries combined.
Yes, the military budget is so complicated by design that it's the only federal agency that still cannot pass an audit. They think maybe this government department can successfully get through an audit by maybe 2025, and they've been working on it for about 10 years. So we'll wait and see. You know, meanwhile, the complexities of that budget just proliferate so that it's really hard to figure out what we are spending and how much we're spending. And that is, again, I think, by design.
Yeah, as you point out, and you have graphs in your book that reveal how, even though with slight dip after various wars, whether World War II or Vietnam or Iraq, Afghanistan, the spending then skyrockets up. And so there's right. This steady upward trajectory. And as you point out, these levels don't include or reveal so many other hidden costs. For example, nuclear weaponry that's hidden in the Department of Energy budget, and on and on and on. So what by traditional metrics tell us that the military budget is the largest component of the U.S. budget outside of Social Security. There are many more costs that can't even be counted.
Yep. The military budget always is roughly equivalent to the rest of the budget. All those different expenditures on the civilian side of the budget put together.
Well, just to wrap up here, Miriam Pemberton, we know that Congress members Barbara Lee and Mark Pocan have been trying to push Congress to move at least 10% of military funding to fund urgent human and environmental needs. And they've created this Defense Spending Reduction Caucus in Congress. But that's still just moving 10% of the military funding, which of course has increased many more times than that over the last 50 years. What do you think of that movement in Congress?
It certainly has had a setback with Putin invading Ukraine. Has created a, you know, an explosion of military spending around the world, not just for the United States, but of course the United States spending dwarfs every other country. And I think, you know, a 10% cut is a good place to start. There are lots of very detailed accounts of what could be cut with no sacrifice to national security. And then with respect to what I think needs to be our new national industrial policy focused on climate change, we got a good beginning, I think, for a climate-focused industrial policy in the Inflation Reduction Act that was just passed. But the amount that's going to go to clean energy and transport infrastructure with that policy and with that new funding is less than 5% of what we will be continuing to spend on the military. And I think those are misplaced priorities.
They certainly are. And thank you again, Miriam Pemberton, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, for joining us today on KBOO and for your excellent book that I recommend to everyone as a must read, Six Stops on the National Security Tour, Rethinking Warfare Economies.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Laurie Mercier and Miriam Pemberton discussing climate change and the national security budget, followed by a clip from the classic song, War, sung by Edwin Starr. You are tuned to KBOO, your community radio station in Portland. Jeremy Brecker is a labor activist and writer who has studied popular uprisings in the U.S., what leads up to them, and the profound impacts they can have. With widespread dissatisfaction over the political failure to address climate change, are conditions now ripe for another political upheaval, like those we saw in the 30s, or again in the 60s? Bill Resnick takes up that question with Jeremy. They discuss prospects for popular resistance to corporate plans to combat climate change with expensive technologies of dubious value that primarily function to fatten corporate coffers.
Hi, Jeremy Brecker. Once again, welcome to KBOO.
Very good to be with you.
Jeremy Brecker, as a student in the late 1960s and early 1970s, he got interested in labor history, began reading, discovered what were then obscure reports and books, mostly ignored, and assembled those reports into a book titled Strike. Along with several other books by other scholars, they transformed the study of American and labor history, at least for the left. Strike is about popular upheaval when working people say enough, when the conditions of life are intolerable. Jeremy, in your adult life, you have always been an activist and writer, known on the left for your 13 books early on Strike, later Save the Humans, Common Preservation in Action. Recently, in 2010, you co-founded with Joe Eline the Labor Network for Sustainability, aiming to build a labor union coalition, along with so many other left movements, not just in this country, but around the world. So, Jeremy, in Save the Planet, you suggested we are well into another great popular upheaval. Tell us why you see a coming popular upheaval.
So, of course, we never really know what's going to happen. Prediction is hard, especially about the future, as Yogi Berra said. But we certainly are seeing a level of crisis worldwide, as well as in our own country, that is one of the indicators of a crisis that is shaking up and disturbing and undermining the daily lives of ordinary folks and undermining the adaptations that people usually use to get by from day to day and week to week and year to year, and making it more and more difficult for people to just say, well, I'm going to figure out how to just maintain my life and my livelihood, and I'm not going to worry about bigger, broader concerns. That's getting harder and harder to do. We see it in the area of climate, where at the moment we're facing a level of climate disruptions and climate destruction, both in this country and worldwide, that I don't have to tell you folks in on the West Coast about, because you're experiencing it in your bodies and your homes right now. And that has been steadily worsening and is inevitably bound to continue worsening. But we also see it in our economic context, where the possibility of just making a living is getting less and less for more and more people. And we are facing both devastating inflation. You know, we have had a case where the working class is basically making the same amount of money that it was when I started out studying these things in 1973, but now we're facing a nearly 10% inflation rate. It's like getting a 10% wage cut for almost all the population, and at the same time, we're looking at economic crisis, both as a result of the war in Ukraine and as a result of the aftermath of the pandemic, as well as the tremendous over-indebtedness, both of governments and of corporations, and also of ordinary people. So putting all that together, we're facing the kind of conditions that jar people and wake them up and make them say, you know what, we can't go on living this way, we have to do something else. And that is the point at which people begin to find new ways to act, new ways to take on the system that's oppressing them and resist its effects and begin to transform it. And we can see that now in a significant, though still fairly modest way, with the rise of new forms of independent unionism, where workers at places like Amazon and Starbucks are creating their own organizations, organizing themselves, sometimes, though not always, with help and support from the established labor movement, but using their power of overproduction and their ability to withdraw their cooperation from the powers that be in order to challenge things, shake things up, and force improvements for their conditions and for the conditions of others who are in the same situation. So that's the big picture of why we're likely to be looking at new forms and significant new forms of popular action and popular upheaval.
my understanding of climate science is that the scientists are now unanimous that, climate disasters will get more frequent, more dangerous, more threatening, and that capital will not act. Nearly all corporations, including all the fossil fuel industries, are now greenwashing, of course, and promising to take action in their processing and products to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But all corporations and financiers are addicted to exercising power, accumulating wealth, and indeed they're developing their own climate action plan. What do you make of that, the imminence of the climate threat?
We are right now in a kind of climate catastrophe that is devastating every part of our country. A third of Pakistan is underwater, and we face droughts, forest fires, and bizarre extreme weather events of all kinds right now and in all parts of the country and all parts of the world. And I think really, and the poll data supports this, we've really reached a point where the idea of denial of the realities of climate change have faded to a tiny minority, and most people, though they may not want to think about it and talk about it, have come to realize that, in fact, we are not only expecting, but we are in a climate catastrophe. There's an interesting series of studies of poll data came out in the last week or so showing that two-thirds or more of Americans are deeply worried and concerned about climate change and want serious government action to address it. But two-thirds of people think that they feel that way, but other people don't feel that way. Their estimate of how other people feel is completely fallacious because of the propaganda that we've been subject to that says, oh, nobody's really worried about climate change. So the first thing that all of us have to do is talk to our friends, talk to our neighbors, talk to our families and say, you know what, I'm worried, I bet you are too, and begin to share the fact that the great majority of our fellow country people and fellow citizens are freaked out about what's happening. And that is what needs to lay the groundwork for a much larger scale, more effective kind of action. Second thing is we've seen global climate action on a very large scale, the largest scale being the massive student climate strikes that took place with millions and millions and millions of participants around the world. And they were largely cut off by the coronavirus pandemic, which made the particular kind of action that they were engaging in difficult or impossible. I think that we're likely to see now a new wave taking off from that, but on a far bigger scale as people realize this is the only hope. Their own action is the only hope for addressing climate change. The corporations aren't going to do it. Governments are not going to do it until their populations absolutely insist that they do. And so that is the strategy that's necessary to address climate change. And that realization, that reality will, and in fact already is, becoming more and more apparent to more and more people. Everyone, of course, sits around and waits for somebody else to act and says, oh, Jesus is so terrible. I wish somebody would do something about it. But we're in the middle of the process through which people come to realize, you know what? That somebody is me. That somebody is us.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The variety is in the movements from below we cover. I've been talking to Jeremy Brecker, an activist, a writer. His books include Classic Strike and Later Save the Humans, Common Preservation in Action. It disperses working class power when they get organized and act together today to transform societies and preserve human life from threats of climate change and environmental collapse. So, Jeremy, you've written that the upheaval must ultimately be joined by much of the world's population, and the labor movement, much strengthened and active, not only active, transformed, in fact. Tell us about that.
Well, we have seen a very, very long period of decline and defeat for the American labor movement. And in many cases, similar realities around the rest of the world, certainly with some important exceptions. But that's been the general pattern. And the dynamic of globalization, in which the corporations can go anywhere in the world and force workers anywhere to compete with the lowest paid and most oppressed workers in the world, and bring wages and conditions down in accord with that, and in which countries are put into competition to see who's going to have the least environmental protections, who's going to have the least protection of workers' working conditions and of the population's living conditions. We've been seeing that for 40 years, and it's had a devastating effect all around the world. You are beginning to see new expressions, new forms of self-organization on the part of working people. And it certainly isn't yet a force that is fully able to contest with and grapple with global capital. But you're seeing the development of forms that are or have the promise of moving beyond the limitations of organized labor as we've known it over the last half century, and moving towards more effective forms of struggle, more effective forms of organization, better ways for working people to figure out what their interests are and how they are going to meet them. And obviously, the new forms of independent labor organization that we've been seeing at places like Starbucks and Amazon are, let's hope, a straw in the wind pointing toward the emergence of forms of worker self-organization that are highly democratic and involve people controlling their own struggles for their own liberation from the forces of capital, climate change, and other forms of corporate destruction.
My sense of labor for a long time was, in fact, representing their workers pretty well, basically who want to protect their current jobs. They're very afraid of losing jobs. It seems to me, though, that people are recognizing that in the union there is power. That recognition that you have to act together is becoming far more prevalent.
I think one of the most positive things we've seen developing in the labor movement, along with new forms of independent unionism, is emergence of the idea of bargaining for the common good. And this is something that many unions, like teachers and service employees and others, have been developing, where they say the real problems facing working people are not just in the workplace, and they're not just in the relationship of workers to their immediate boss, but there are much wider social and society-wide economic issues as well. And so we have to negotiate, and if necessary, we have to strike, not just for the interests of our particular group of workers in our own immediate workplace, but for much broader issues like health care for everyone, like education for everyone, like labor rights for the 90% of workers who are not represented by unions, and like protection against the devastation of climate change and other environmental threats. And I think the redefinition of what is a labor movement and what are the real concerns of workers that they can and need to fight around, that reconsideration is crucial to creating a labor movement that is far less fragmented than ours, that's based on much broader pictures of principles of solidarity, and that for that reason is also much more powerful and more effective.
You wrote about that in your report, Making a Living on a Living Planet. I'm particularly interested in the Minneapolis janitor workers. They're not high-paid workers, but they were striking for a green training fund. And some state coalitions, in fact, are changing, moving towards seeking laws and policies towards climate-safe energy and that create good jobs for everybody.
The janitors union in Minneapolis did something quite extraordinary. These are people who clean the large commercial buildings in the downtown, and they are from all over the world, and many of them are from countries that have had severe floods and storms as a result of climate change. Some of them have been forced to migrate because of climate change conditions in their countries, and they are very aware of the threat of climate change, not only in Minneapolis where they live now, but also in the countries that they've come from. So this union, which represents many workers of many different employers, the international cleaning companies that have the contracts in the skyscrapers downtown, they wanted to find some ways that they could directly address climate change. And there have been a number of things that they've done locally in terms of supporting workers, for example, who are trying to close an incinerator, which is a major source both of pollution in poorer neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color and immigrant neighborhoods, and also a significant source of greenhouse gases that are furthering the destruction of our climate. But they were looking for a way that they could actually use the collective bargaining process to do something about climate change. And they realized that they were operating the heating systems and the cooling systems and the air-moving systems in these gigantic downtown skyscrapers, and that they were the people who were in a position to provide high-quality maintenance and control for the heating and cooling systems in those buildings. And so as part of their bargaining demands, they demanded a green training fund, which would provide training to the workers who operate these cleaning systems. They're classified as cleaning workers, but they're actually operating the systems in these buildings. And so the companies they were negotiating with poo-pooed it and didn't really pay any attention and made very inadequate offers on all fronts, wages and others. And so they decided they would have a strike. They would do, for starters, a one-day demonstration strike to persuade their employers that they were serious and that their employers would be wise to take their demands seriously. So they shut down the buildings and had vigorous demonstrations in the streets of Minneapolis with support from student and youth groups and support from climate groups like 350.org, and with support from poor neighborhoods with people of color and immigrants, especially the ones that they have been working with to fight the incinerator. And putting all that together, they made a tremendous impression on the city and apparently on the employers, because the employers immediately shifted their approach, got very serious about negotiating, and made a wide range of concessions to the workers' demands, including the establishment of a training fund, which is now operating and graduated its first students, janitor students, a few months ago.
Wow, that's an inspiring story, and undoubtedly is going to occur more in the future. Jeremy Brecker, thanks for talking to you this week. We'll talk again next Monday.
Great to talk to you. And thanks so much to your listeners for participating in this discussion. And remember to go out and talk to your friends and your neighbors and your family and tell them, I'm worried about climate change. Are you?
Thanks a lot, Jeremy.
take a second to reckon.
It takes time to build.
That was the Beastie Boys with their song about U.S. failures to combat climate change called It Takes Time to Build. Before that, Bill Resnick and Jeremy Brecker talked about prospects for a popular uprising in the face of corporate-caused climate catastrophe. Closing our show today, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker take us on a virtual tour of the Black Lives Matter photography exhibit at the Portland Art Museum, which showcases the work of local BIPOC artists. They take up questions about how mass social justice movements are represented in popular culture and why that matters.
An exhibit at the Portland Art Museum that runs through early November features the works of six BIPOC photographers following the racial justice protests after the murder of George Floyd in 2020. The narrative at the entrance to the exhibit provides what the photographers offer as a critical lens on 100 days of demonstrations in Portland. Quote, through the growing pains of organizing and sustaining hundreds of direct community action events, the fire in Portland never ceased to burn. The fire that fueled righteous rage and passion in the hearts of those who participated bore witness and were inspired to make change. Well, Mike, let's talk about our first impressions of this fabulous exhibit and then take up some of what such projects carry and their potential to structure public memory of mass protests. The exhibit is aptly titled Perspectives, which brings to mind the famous cultural critic, John Berger, who talked about ways of seeing. Well, what did you see when you entered this exhibit?
I thought it was extraordinary, Jan. What I saw to begin with was the most striking thing was drone photos hovering over Pioneer Square, looking down, very abstract with the terracotta buildings on one side. It's sort of hard to get yourself oriented. But then you realize the square was packed with people. And another drone photo of the Burnside Bridge, just packed with people. And I'd realized the extent to which the sort of raggedy end of the demonstrations had caused me to somewhat undercut my sense of all that had happened. It reminded me that for a while at the beginning, the sight of a white cop looking the camera square in the eye as he choked the life out of George Floyd was such a vivid, compelling moment that validated the Black Lives Matter movement that had started earlier in 2013 with the deaths of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. It had just made it clear that, yes, this is an supreme indifference to Black life shown here, and that we were galvanized and everybody poured out. And of course, Portland was together, but Portland didn't stay together. And the other pictures there include some extraordinary combat photography of tear gas foaming, of cops decked out in layers of protection, of people engaged, people yelling, the whole range of people presented by these six very different photographers, offering individuals looking you squarely in the eye, people full of hope and passion in the midst of a demonstration, intimate shots, big sweep distant shots, all kinds of photographs and perspectives that reclaimed for me to a large extent what was really a profound series of events.
And it very much earned that title of Perspectives, not in that typical, the conservative anti versus the pro-social justice side, but more within this movement, the different ways of looking at it. And I agree there was something particularly compelling about these almost mosaic abstract images from a distance, drone shots of masses of people where each individual was pretty indistinguishable from the other. And then these very intimate shots with relationships, moods of people, and both celebration and grief and mourning and anger. And when you walk into the exhibit, there's that juxtaposition right at the beginning. with this mosaic of people, thousands of people. And then alongside of that is this mural-sized image of a young, what looks like a young Black man on the top of a car. And he projects a kind of defiance, but also gracefulness and sure-footedness. I really like the choice of that image that is set aside the image of the mass movement. Because sometimes mass movements, the individuals involved get lost in the masses.
Yeah, that was a great picture, dancing on an SUV.
Yeah. So there were six photographers that created this sequence of images, including Emery Barnes, Joseph Blake, Linnaeus Boland Godby, David Jacobo, Mariah Harris, and Byron Merritt. You know, you mentioned the drone shots of crowds and police and clouds of tear gas. That was, I think, by Joseph Blake. But I was surprised there was not much in the photography of the police themselves. They were actually fairly small in the overall picture here. There were some of, like you say, combat positions, but overall it seemed to almost marginalize the police in the whole story that unfolds. Did you have any sense of that?
No, I disagree. I think there were plenty of cop shots of people showing a photograph from the side of a row of cops decked out, one intimate shot of all the different things dangling from the cop's chest, all the different methods of repression that were easily at hand. And finally, there was a video there. I don't know if you caught that video of actual tear gas foaming, leaf blowers. It was basically combat, which was successful. I mean, basically, Trump's people were routed militarily from the Justice Building. An extraordinary thing. It would have been great to declare victory and quit, but of course, injustice continued. Racism has not stopped. People went on. But yeah, I thought there was a pretty good coverage of cops and general cops in a row, a couple of individuals in that video sequence.
Yeah, I liked the focus on, you know, as I was a clinical psychologist and therapist in the past, I've been interested in how people sustain themselves over a long period of time of struggle. And there was one photographer, Linnaeus Boland Godby, who is an artist and a therapist, who created this series of photographs on art therapy events as places of healing. And of course, that was amidst the pandemic that all this unfolded. And most everyone there was wearing masks. But this part of movements that itself is an important perspective, you know, how you sustain yourselves in an ongoing fight. And some of that sustaining, as you said, was done not very well in the course of that movement. And sometimes as people get more desperate, fewer crowds, things thin out, you can get more chaotic expressions of violence. But here, I think the focus was on the relational side of movements, children coming with their parents, couples, families, as well as people gathering in these places to celebrate and be creative, as well as express anger and outrage.
Well, the range was exceptional in this show. All the things you've described, plus Mariah Harris had a couple of great photographs in color of like the wall of moms during that period, and of one of women looking at the camera with lights holding up, one that has really a great shot of eyes on the brink of tears. Of course, eyes became so important. They're always expressive, and we communicate all kinds of meaning with our eyes. And that truth is really heightened by all the masks that everyone was wearing, because of course, this was happening all at the height of COVID. And the photographer's use of masks and reliance on them in some of their pictures was really deft and really meaningful.
There was also a series of photographs where the eyes were clearly blacked out for identity purposes.
That's right.
There are different ethics about journalism and field photography, where in general you do not need to get permission because people are in spaces where they're intending to make a public statement. But then there also are other questions if you're focusing on someone or if they're in a situation that puts them in risk legally, then you have other obligations. So it'd be interesting to know how those discussions unfolded and their responsibilities to the subjects in the photographs.
Well, yeah, there were a couple of exceptional pictures, really large blow-up shots of people like on the move in midair with the black bar over their eyes. Thin black bar, so much of their face was revealed.
Yeah.
But it was itself almost part of the work, was the use of those black bars.
Yeah, and especially as one of the whitest big cities in this country, Portland did play kind of an outsized role in national protests and has in the past a long history of protests and sustained resistance. So I think it was also conveying a legacy here of activism and resistance. It's important. And of course, particularly in that Portland has a long history of racism, including elected leaders and sheriffs who belong to the Ku Klux Klan, and as a kind of sanctuary for white homeland people, for white supremacists in the 80s and 90s. So there is this mix of histories that I think are complicated, but this is part of that history. Speaking of white supremacists and the legacy of white supremacy, what was your take on the fourth floor gallery that includes some reflections on the history of racism in Portland, reflections on the Black Lives Matter movement, and where in a corner you see the Thomas Jefferson statue pulled down from its place in front of Jefferson High School, now occupying a humble corner of the museum under the heading Untitled Work?
Well, it was the whole exhibit, by the way, is a remarkable expression of all the creativity and reality and presence of Black people. I mean, Portland is indeed the whitest city, but that doesn't mean there aren't 35 or 40,000 Black people. There's two Black newspapers published here. They get picked up by somebody. There's a really significant presence here that got highlighted with a good show on the fourth floor. It's very multimedia. There's like a bodega. There's some different forms of expression. And the Jefferson statue, I mean, that's a profound thing.
The statues coming down was part of the Black Lives Matter movement, and statues that represented the legacy and the continued idealization of white supremacists. Thomas Jefferson was caught up in that dismantling of heroes.
Well, you know, Jefferson wrote very articulate writings that have inspired people all over the world, movements for independence, the Declaration of Independence. But he also coasted on the backs of 600 to 700 slaves that he owned, that he did not release like some of the other founding fathers. So he raises the issue in some ways of aristocrats in general. All the writings and all the music, the art, for the most part, was created over the last 1,000 years by people who depended entirely on the works of other people, on the back-breaking efforts of other people. And Jefferson is a perfect paradox. I mean, you can make a picture of him as heroic, but you can also make a picture of him as a sponger, as somebody who fooled himself. He pretended to be what he was not, somebody who masked from himself how much he exploited hundreds, not just a few, but hundreds of people. So those are both real. It's a big paradox that I don't know quite how to sort out, but you cannot deny either side of him.
Yeah. And, you know, Jefferson High School, the historic Black high school in Portland, was named Jefferson for a reason. And perhaps the other side of that legacy was really brought to the fore during the Black Lives Matter movement and pulling down the statue. And it's appropriate to put it in a museum where it's an object of discussion, where you have to look at also the commentary around it and discussion around it, but that it still has a place somewhere.
Exactly. I think that's great. He should not be simply deified and immortalized, quote unquote, by being placed prominently, but neither should he be forgotten. He can't be forgotten. He has already inspired and been quoted by people leading revolutionary movements around the world.
There are a lot of elements to this exhibit on both the second floor and the fourth floor. It's important to take them both in, but it's worth several visits and interesting discussions. So once again, this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about Perspectives, the exhibit at the Portland Art Museum that runs through early November. Catch it while you can.
Yes, Jan, and I urge people, the Portland Museum deserves kudos for offering the space and time to put this terrific show together, and you should really go see it.
That's it for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Lori Mercier, Bill Resnick, Jan Hawken, and Mike Snedeker for their contributions, Denise Morris for editing assistance, and especially our guests, Miriam Pemberton and Jeremy Brecker. As always, the Moles are grateful for the hard work of the KBOO staff who keep community radio alive in Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host this morning. Catch the Moles again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for views, reviews, and interviews from the ground up. I'm going to leave you with a song by Her, I Can't Breathe. Thanks for listening.
Starting a war, screaming peace at the same time. All the corruption and justice, the same crimes. Always a problem if we do or don't fight and we die. We don't have the same right. What is a gun to a man that surrenders? What's it gonna take for someone to defend her? If we all agree that we're equal as people, then why can't we see?